The headlines this hour: Iran expresses its readiness for prisoner swap with the U.S., saying this will pave the way for the release of its nationals held on baseless charges of violating illegal sanctions. Local Syrian sources say Turkey's military has warned citizens in northern Syria to stay in their homes as Ankara deploys drones and troops to border cities in Aleppo Governorate. Also ahead, Britain's inflation rate hitting a record high in 4 decades as soaring food and energy prices deepen the cost of living crisis. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mias. Thanks for joining us. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says the Islamic Republic is ready to swap prisoners with the U.S. Nasser Kanani said that Tehran has repeatedly expressed its readiness to discuss the issue of prisoners exchange with Washington, irrespective of indirect talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. He said the swap will pave the way for the release of Iranian nationals held in the U.S. on baseless charges of violating illegal sanctions imposed on Tehran. Kanani called on the U.S. to set aside, quote, theatrical shows and, instead, eliminate obstacles to the prisoner swap. Special envoy of the Iranian president for Afghanistan says the Islamic Republic has followed the policy of interaction with the Taliban government based on the support it enjoys from the Afghan people. Hassan Kazemi Ghomi made the remarks during a press conference on the first anniversary of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. He said, however, that Tehran would not recognize the Taliban until an all-inclusive government is formed there. Ghomi also touched on America's hasty exit, saying Washington definitely failed in Afghanistan. But he warned that the U.S. is still in the pursuit of its goals as American spy services are operating there.
A year ago, the United States marked a chaotic end to 20 years of war in Afghanistan, following a hurried pullout of troops that saw the Taliban reclaiming power in the country. Here in Tehran, Iranian officials and political analysts sat together to discuss different aspects of the incident. They regard Washington's exit as an escape from the Afghan quagmire after it failed to achieve its geostrategic objectives there.
Today, the significance of Afghanistan has not diminished in the eyes of the Americans. They didn't leave the country to let China, Russia, and Iran invest in it. The U.S. had to leave because it totally failed there. But it will continue to make the best of its efforts to destabilize Afghanistan.
Last year, in late August, the U.S. evacuated thousands of troops from Afghanistan in just a few days, following President Joe Biden's order to exit fully by August 30, 2021. The withdrawal marked the end of 2 decades of war in Afghanistan, which sought to bring peace to the country, but left a trail of chaos and mayhem.
The United States not only did not fight terrorism during its 2 decades of presence in Afghanistan, but had a role in many acts of terrorism to legitimize and prolong its presence there.
1 year after the U.S. pullout, Afghanistan is still bogged down in turmoil. The country has been the scene of recurrent terrorist attacks, some of which have been claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. Iran says the U.S. has resorted to Daesh to wage a proxy war in Afghanistan to make up for its losses.
The U.S. continues to back terrorists such as Daesh to destabilize Afghanistan. Aside from Daesh, it has been hosting some 7,000 Afghan military forces from the previous Afghan army to train them. What's the goal of such military trainings?
Since the Taliban takeover, Iran has been calling for an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan as the ultimate way out of the persisting instability in the war-torn country.
Experts here describe the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan a lasting shame for America and the worst fiasco after its loss in the 1950s Vietnam War. They say the chaotic exit is also a lesson for the region that wherever Washington has set foot, it has left nothing but mess and destruction for the hosting nations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Turkey's military is warning citizens in northern Syria to stay in their homes as Ankara gets prepared to stage an attack. Local Syrian sources say the strike alert comes as Turkish drones and troops have been deployed to border cities in Aleppo Governorate. Turkey has ramped up its attacks on Syrian border cities recently. 3 Syrian military personnel were killed and 6 others injured in Tuesday's airstrikes on the outskirts of Aleppo. Syrian military sources say the strikes are part of Turkey's long-running efforts in support of terrorist groups in the country's north. Damascus has responded by targeting Turkish bases and armed groups inside of Syria. It has vowed not to let any attack on its army positions go unanswered. Earlier, we reached out to our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, to talk about Turkey's fresh strike on northern Syria. He says the Syrian army has vowed to directly respond to Turkish attacks.
The Syrian army will respond back directly to any gunfire on all front lines. This is definitely a significant development happening there in the north, perhaps the first time we see such kind of direct clashes or targeting between Syria and Turkey over there. Also, during the night, just yesterday, some mosques in Turkish villages on the Turkish side of the border announced warnings using the speakers of those mosques to the families to stay indoor, as there will be a military ground operation by Turkey into Syria. This amid reconnaissance drones flying over the borderline, and also amid reports that the Turkish army deployed a large number of troops on that borderline. However, following that announcement inside mosques over there, the governor of Gaziantep, Gul over there, said on Twitter on his account that the announcements exceeded its purpose and that the situation is normal and there's nothing outside routine, which also indicated then that it seems that there will be no military operation. It's just kind of attacks by the Turkish air force and also artillery. But definitely this is an escalation from the Turkish side, and definitely this is an attack and an aggression which undermines Syria's sovereignty.
Israel and Turkey have agreed to restore full diplomatic ties nearly 4 years after the two sides expelled each other's ambassadors over Israel's deadly aggression against the Gaza Strip. The Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid's office said in a statement that the move followed a steady improvement in relations between Ankara and Tel Aviv. The statement followed a conversation between Lapid and the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. It also highlighted expanding trade and strengthening regional stability among the joint goals. Meanwhile, the Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu said the restoration of ties did not mean that Ankara would abandon Palestinians and their cause. Two sides expelled diplomats in 2018 after Israeli forces killed dozens of Palestinians during their weekly protests in Gaza as part of the Great March of Return rallies and the U.S. opening of an embassy in Al-Quds. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has vowed to continue resistance against Israel until the liberation of the entire Palestine. The group's representative to Iran made the pledge during a presser in Tehran on the achievements during Israel's recent deadly onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Nasser Abu Sharif also referred to the death of the Islamic Jihad's senior members in Israeli strikes, saying those killings won't stop the movement's activities. He noted that the Islamic Jihad is well organized and that new figures would replace those martyred. Speaking at the venue, the Palestinian Hamas resistance movement's representative to Iran vowed to avenge the blood of the martyrs. Khaled al-Qadoumi also dismissed claims that the resistance groups are disunited. He said that Hamas and the Islamic Jihad have been working in coordination since 2014. Israel launched a three-day offensive on Gaza on August 5, killing dozens of Palestinians. Response: the Islamic Jihad fired rockets, or hundreds of rockets, some of them deep inside of Israel. Over a dozen European diplomats have visited Gaza to assess the humanitarian situation in the blockaded coastal territory following the recent Israeli military aggression. Ashraf Shannon has the details.
Diplomats from the European Union, including heads of European diplomatic missions in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, arrived in Gaza Tuesday morning. The senior European officials toured the Shati refugee camp upon arriving in the blockaded territory. Their short visit comes less than 2 weeks after the Israeli regime launched a three-day military aggression on Gaza that claimed the lives of 49 people, including 17 children.
We come here only 10 days after the ceasefire has been agreed. A ceasefire which gave end to 3 days of terrible fighting, where far too many civilians, far too many children and women lost their lives. It's also to show solidarity to the Gazans in general, but also to the kids, the children who lost their lives, who were injured.
The ambassadors of the European Union made an inspection tour of the wounded during the recent Israeli aggression at Gaza's Shifa Hospital.
We briefed the European delegation on the humanitarian situation in Gaza and the dire condition of hospitals. The delegation also visited the patients and those who were injured during the recent Israeli military aggression. We also told them about the lack of medicines and hospital supplies because of the Israeli blockade.
The brief visit by the European diplomats comes at a time when the people of Gaza are suffering under a tight Israeli blockade that has been in place since 2007. Most Gazans rely on handouts to survive, and many of them are unemployed.
It's clear that many more people fell below the poverty line. Unemployment rate has significantly increased. Health and education problems have become even more problematic.
Palestinians and human rights groups have repeatedly slammed the European countries for their failure to take an action aimed at ending Israeli violations against the besieged territory.
Many here believe that the visit by the European diplomats will not improve the situation for the people of Gaza, given Israel's impunity and the failure of the international community to hold the regime accountable for its crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Israel has approved the plan to build hundreds more settler units in the occupied city of Al-Quds in defiance of international law. The Israeli municipality in Al-Quds issued a tender for the construction of over 400 settler units in the Sur Bahir neighborhood. The move was condemned by the Palestinian Foreign Ministry and Hamas resistance movement. They called it yet another Israeli attempt to Judaize Al-Quds and to change its Islamic identity. The ministry said, quote, "The racist, expansionist, colonial scheme undermines efforts to launch talks aimed at finding a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict." It also urged the international community to force Israel to put an end to its policy of settlement expansion. Meanwhile, a Hamas spokesman said the Israeli crimes would be confronted with the unity of the Palestinians and their resistance. All Israeli settlements are deemed illegal under international law as they are built on occupied land. Britons are feeling the pinch of the deepening cost of living crisis as inflation hits a new record high. For the first time in more than four decades, the UK has registered a double-digit inflation rate. According to the Office for National Statistics, the Consumer Price Index rose to 10.1% in July from 9.4% the previous month. That's even higher than what the economists were expecting. Food prices are skyrocketing, and officials say that is the main contributor to the rising inflation. The Bank of England has already increased the interest rate six times to bring the situation under control. It is now predicting an inflation of above 13% for October and a long recession at the end of the year. Now to the latest developments from the war in Ukraine. Russian forces say that they have attacked multiple Ukrainian military targets using high-precision weapons. Ukrainian officials say two civilians have been killed and seven wounded in Russian shelling in the past 24 hours. Kiev says its armed forces have repelled Russian attacks in several directions, including Slavyansk. On the southeastern front, Moscow says Ukraine is trying to provoke Russian counterattacks by shelling the city of Inner Hodar, where the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant is located. In the meantime, the UN Secretary General Guterres is scheduled to meet Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the western city of Lviv to discuss the conflict, especially the situation surrounding the nuclear plant, which is currently in Russian control. The last French soldier has been expelled from Mali, ending nearly a decade of military disaster and humanitarian catastrophe in the African country. The new government of Bamako has refused to even allow a French ambassador to return, causing many to wonder if the era of French neocolonialism has begun its ending. Rami Massari has more from Paris.
The last French soldiers have left Mali after being expelled by Bamako following 9 years of unpopular war, which has left Mali one of the poorest countries in the world. 2.5 million refugees have been created, thousands of civilians were killed, and the politicians who initially colluded with Paris, widely accused of corruption, were ousted by popular anti-French protests in 2020.
Les Maliens ne savaient pas que vous êtes là. Malians have been dying for 9 years. Things have only gotten worse. It has spread to Niger, Burkina Faso, Mauritania, and elsewhere. After 9 years, this hasn't worked, and Malians want results. However, when Malians made their revolution, France criticized and opposed it.
The roots of the Mali conflict run deep, but they all feature French aggression. In 2011, Nicolas Sarkozy illegally dropped 40 tons of arms to help overthrow the Socialist People's Libyan Arab Republic led by Muammar Gaddafi. Those arms spread to northern Mali, where the nomadic Tuaregs used them in their conflict with southern Mali, which has existed ever since imperialist France drew Mali's irregular bowtie-shaped borders. Paris alleged the Tuaregs were religious radicals, and in 2013, François Hollande invaded Mali prior to receiving the approval of the United Nations. Many allege that uranium deposits, which keep French nuclear power cheap, gold mines, and the desire to maintain the neo-colonial system known as France-Afrique were the primary motivations for a war which would be dubbed France's Afghanistan.
Many of France's former colonies gained their independence in the 1950s, but since 1960, France has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa.
France has been completely wrong about so many things, and especially the times we now live in. This is a multipolar world, and neocolonialism has failed. Africa no longer wants France and the West as their only ally and as their tutors. Africa has changed, and we will choose our own partners and our own destiny.
The war killed 59 French soldiers, but French imperialism in Mali was cited repeatedly as justification in terror attacks in France, which cost hundreds of lives. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Moving on to the latest developments from the Korean Peninsula, with the reports of North Korea firing two cruise missiles towards the sea. The South Korean Defense Ministry says the two missiles were launched off the country's west coast. So far, no confirmation from Pyongyang. North Korea has been working on its nuclear program, despite UN sanctions in recent years. Pyongyang argues that it needs nuclear weapons for self-defense purposes. It's opposed to an irreversible denuclearization, viewing it as a breach of its sovereignty. Just hours before the launch, South Korea's president called for talks with the neighboring North, who said any future dialogue should eventually bring the two sides closer to peace, rather than being just a political show. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Former President Donald J. Trump and his allies have given often conflicting defenses of his retention of classified documents, without addressing why he had kept them. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Zolan Kano-Youngs and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled, Trump's Shifting Explanations Follow a Familiar Playbook. First, he said that he was working and cooperating with government agents who he claimed had inappropriately entered his home. Then, when the government revealed that the FBI, during its search, had recovered nearly a dozen sets of documents that were marked classified, he suggested the agents had planted evidence. Finally, his aides claimed he had a standing order to declassify documents that left the Oval Office for his residence, and that some of the material was protected by attorney-client and executive privilege. Those are the ever-shifting explanations that former President Donald J. Trump and his aides have given regarding what FBI agents found last week in a search of his residence at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida. Donald Trump and his allies have cast the search as a partisan assault, while amplifying conflicting arguments about the handling of sensitive documents and failing to answer a question at the center of the federal investigation. Why was he keeping those documents, some still marked classified, at an unsecured Florida resort when officials had sought for a year to retrieve them? The often contradictory and unsupported defenses perpetuated by Donald Trump and his team since the FBI search follow a familiar playbook of the former president's. He has used it over decades, but most visibly when he was faced with the investigation into whether his campaign in 2016 conspired with Russians and during his first impeachment trial. In both instances, he claimed victimization and mixed some facts with a blizzard of misleading statements or falsehoods. His lawyers denied that he had tied his administration's withholding of vital military aid to Ukraine to Mr. Trump's desire to invest for investigations into Joseph R. Biden Jr. and his son, Hunter Biden. When information contradicting that defense emerged in a forthcoming book by Donald Trump's former national security advisor, John Bolton, Mr. Trump's lawyers switched to insisting that he hadn't connected the aid to the investigations, but that if he had, it wouldn't have been an impeachable offense. Of the multiple investigations Donald Trump currently faces, including a state inquiry in Georgia and two federal grand jury investigations, all related to his efforts to cling on to power at the end of his presidency, as well as civil and criminal inquiries in New York related to his company. The federal investigation into his handling of sensitive documents taken from the White House has emerged as one of the most potentially damaging. A search warrant made public on Friday, 12th of August, revealed federal agents had recovered top-secret documents when they searched Donald Trump's Florida residence earlier in the week as part of an investigation into possible violations of the Espionage Act and other laws. Among the 11 sets of documents taken were some marked as classified, or TSSCI, shorthand for Top Secret Sensitive Compartmented Information. According to an inventory of the materials seized in the search, those types of documents are meant to be viewed only in secure facilities. The inventory of documents included other material, some described as confidential. The stunning revelation made clear the gravity of the Justice Department's inquiry months after the National Archives and Records Administration said it had discovered classified information in documents that Donald Trump had held onto after leaving the White House. "What he doesn't have the right to do is possess the documents. They are not his," Jason R. Barron, a former director of litigation at the National Archives for more than a decade, has said. "There should be no presidential records at Mar-a-Lago, whether they are classified or unclassified, or subject to executive privilege or subject to attorney-client privilege. Documents covered by executive privilege are meant to be kept within the government." A spokesman for Donald Trump did not respond to a message seeking comment. Donald Trump used Hillary Clinton's mishandling of classified material, as seen in the Justice Department investigation into her email practices in 2015 and 2016, as political fodder during his first campaign. He is considering another national campaign for 2024, and questions about whether he mishandled the nation's secrets could be problematic for him, even absent an investigation. After officials with National Archives tried for several months to retrieve material from Donald Trump, he turned over 15 boxes of documents in January. The next month, the National Archives confirmed the discovery of the classified information and referred the matter to the Justice Department. Over the following months, officials came to learn that Donald Trump still had additional material at Mar-a-Lago that some of his advisers urged him to hand over. Mr. Trump described the handover of the 15 boxes as an ordinary and routine process. But administrations have been required to turn over documents to the National Archives before leaving office for more than 40 years, as part of the Presidential Records Act that was created in response to President Richard Nixon's attempt to take his documents and recordings with him after resigning in disgrace. Kash Patel, a former Trump administration official, subsequently justified the handling of the documents by saying that Donald Trump had declassified them before leaving office, a claim echoed by the former president this week. In an appearance on Fox News Channel on Friday night, the right-wing writer John Solomon, one of Donald Trump's representatives for interacting with the National Archives, read a statement from the former president's office asserting Mr. Trump had a standing order during his presidency that documents removed from the Oval Office and taken to his residence were deemed to be declassified the moment he moved them. That claim would not resolve the investigation. Two of the laws referred to in the search warrant executed this week criminalize the taking or concealment of government records, regardless of whether they had anything to do with national security. And laws against taking material with restricted national security information are not dependent on whether the material is technically classified. John Bolton, who served as Donald Trump's third national security advisor over 17 months, said he had never heard of the standing order that Mr. Trump's office claimed to have in place. It is, he said, almost certainly a lie. I was never briefed on any such order, procedure, policy when I came in, John Bolton said, adding that he had never been told of it while he was working there, and had never heard of such a thing after. If he were to say something like that, you would have to memorialize that so that people would know it existed, he said. What's more, he pointed out, secure facilities for viewing sensitive material were constructed at Donald Trump's clubs in Florida and New Jersey, when he often spent weekends as president, meaning that the documents wouldn't need to be declassified. And if they were declassified, John Bolton said, they would be considered subject to public record requests. He continued, when somebody begins to concoct lies like this, it shows a real level of desperation. The claim that the documents held in the Florida residence were declassified also undercut an assertion one of Mr. Trump's lawyers made back in June. In a written declaration, the lawyer's team said all material marked as classified and stored at Mar-a-Lago had been returned to the government. This week, Donald Trump again accused the Justice Department of acting as a tool for his political opponents, a familiar tactic for a former president who had tried repeatedly to politicize the department during his 4 years in office. Describing the FBI as corrupt, Donald Trump suggested that its agents had planted incriminating material at Mar-a-Lago during the search, and demanded they return documents that he said were protected by executive privilege. Such accusations of political motivation prompted Attorney General Merrick Garland to defend the FBI's agents during brief remarks earlier this week. Donald Trump's unverified accusations also came as the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security last week issued an intelligence bulletin that warned of an increase in threats against federal law enforcement after a search of Mar-a-Lago, including general calls for a civil war or armed rebellion.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
If we look now, the Yazidis and Shimmers of the time, they're very concerned about Imam Hussein. They're concerned about how he's portrayed. They would love to see something like Arba'een, that beautiful communal act of worship. This many people worshiping God, moving in a certain direction. They want to reduce it to meaningless rituals, foolish rituals, things that turn anyone off. So what's that role that Imam Hussein plays? Right now, what's the role he's playing with Sheikh Zakzaki and the movement over there? So the Imam, Misbah al-Huda, reaching out even to his enemies. But why is it some don't get guided? Others, the story that I want to share with you from Imam Hussein, you'll see someone who was completely off, how he got guided. What was different about that person? What's the principle? So that you and I can receive the guidance of our Imam. Salawat, please. There's two traits that I'm going to mention that are good for us to have if we want to receive that guidance from the Imam. He's trying to reach out. He's still guiding even now. If we want to receive his guidance, there are two very important traits that we should have. If we can have these traits mentioned in the Hadith of Ahlul Bayt, then after that, the chances of us being able to receive that guidance, the Imam can take our hand, it's very high. What are those two things? Number one, brothers and sisters, is that a true mu'min or mu'mina? I'm going to read the hadith. It's possible that a mu'min or mu'mina not be perfect. It's not that everybody, in the story of Imam, everybody was there, they were all perfect. No, no. It's possible that a mu'min or mu'mina not be perfect, but there are certain values that that person needs to have. If that person has those values, the Imam is able to reach and take their hand. What are the values that are very important for us to have, even if I'm not perfect, but I want that guidance of the Imam. I want to be one of the soldiers of the Imam. I don't want to be part of the problem. I'm not, in my heart of hearts, a ritualist Muslim. Number one, true believers, brothers and sisters, if they're making a mistake, they're not militant about it. Some people, if they're doing something which is wrong, which Allah doesn't like, and I'm going to mention the hadith where it's room for constant improvement. I'm going to mention the hadith later. There is no one who should say, well, I'm doing all of my wajibat, alhamdulillah, so this discussion has nothing to do with me. I'm going to mention the hadith later. But a mu'min or mu'mina, because we all have room for improvement, the true believer has certain characteristics that allow for that imam to be able to guide them. One of them is that the mu'min or mu'mina isn't militant about their mistakes. If I'm doing something wrong, I should have the chivalry, the honesty, to say that what I'm doing isn't right. Not defend it. Not get angry. What are you, the Haram police? There's some people, they'll admit when they're making a mistake. You call them out, this is incorrect. Brother, sister, you can improve in this area. They'll accept it. Some people, no, very defensive. Listen to this hadith. This is from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. The Imam says this. He says that there are three groups of people who will be the closest to God on Yawm al-Qiyamah when He does the Hisab. When God's taking account, there's three groups of people who will be closest to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. What are those three groups? I'm going to mention one of them. One of them is this. Rajulun, a man. Qala al-haq. He says the truth. Fima alayhi wallah. Whether it be in my interest, whether it be against my interest. If I'm making a mistake, I can admit it. I can say that, no, that's true. What I'm doing is not right. Allah says this. And by the way, there's ahkam about this. Let's say, God forbid, I'm going to give an extreme example. None of us are doing this, but just as an extreme example for us to understand. Let's say someone, God forbid, was drinking alcohol. An alcoholic. Question, from a jurisprudential point of view, is it wajib on me? I'm drinking alcohol, God forbid. Is it wajib on me if someone else is going to drink alcohol? Another Muslim, another mu'min or mu'mina. Is it wajib on me to do al-amr bil-ma'ruf wa nahyan al-munkar? Question. Unfortunately, I'm not practicing in my own life. Is it wajib on me to stop others? What they tell us is this. Even if you, God forbid, are not practicing, you have to say that what God said is this. Those conditions are there. That person should not do that. The person might turn around. Well, then, why are you doing it? The honest person who says the truth, whether it be in my interest or against my interest, what I'm doing is wrong. What Allah said is that. That person can be saved. They're not militant. There's room for improvement. The imam can take their hand. Now, number two, brothers and sisters, is that am I truly, in my heart of hearts, looking to improve, looking to be better? Imam Khomeini, may Allah bless his soul, they said that, the leader says this, he said, after the month of Ramadan, you would meet Imam Khomeini, visibly the imam had gotten better. He was more nurani, constantly improving. But I'm going to mention the hadith. What the Ahlul Bayt want from you and I, this Muharram, every Muharram, is constantly trying to get better. Not pleased with where we are. This is the second trait, very important. Let's look at the hadith. The imam says this is from Imam Baqir. La musibata. There is no calamity, there is no musiba. Kastahanatika bidhamb. Like taking sin lightly. There is no musibah, Imam Baqir says. Like take it, it's okay, God understands. There's some people who are like, what I'm doing is wrong. I don't like it. I'm working to get through it. I'll never defend it. What's right is right, what's wrong is wrong. Call a spade. I'm honest with myself between me and God. The Imam says, this is now the words of the Imam, Imam Sadiq. He says, this person is a mu'min. Hadith. Man sarrathu hasanatu. That person whose good deeds please them. If I'm able, if Allah gives tawfiq, if I'm able to have success, this pleases me. He says, and sa'athu sayyi'atuhu. And when I do sins, it really troubles me. I'm not a perfect mu'min or mu'mina, but I don't justify it. I don't think it's okay. It troubles me. Fahuwa mu'min. Imam, this person is a believer. I'm not militant, looking to improve. If someone has these qualities, the imam can take their hand.
We say you live forever in our hearts and
To Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Researchers find that the U.S. had become an outlier among other rich countries in mortality rates long before the pandemic, and that Americans are dying younger than their peers abroad. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Lynn Paramore Ryder. This article is published under the heading, United States of Death? Study shows worrying mortality rates of broken health system. This is the first part of the story. When it comes to health in the United States, a fundamental prerequisite to a fulfilling life, the U.S. isn't delivering and hasn't been for a long time. Researchers now find that the big picture of health failings is even graver than we already knew. Piles of studies have called attention to the fact that in the country ranking number one in healthcare spending per capita, people are living shorter lives, feeling more depressed, and are more likely to skip treatment due to cost than in many developed nations. In a performance ranking of 11 high-income countries compiled by the Commonwealth Fund in 2021, the American healthcare system came in dead last with the worst outcomes of any of the nations studied. "The only wealth is life," wrote the 19th-century critic John Ruskin. Recent research indicates that America may be rich in dollars, but getting poorer in ways that matter most. In a stunning new report, Missing Americans, Early Death in the United States, between 1933 to 2021, Boston University professor of global health and epidemiology, Jacob Bohr, and colleagues pored over data from the CDC and a global mortality database. During the period investigated, they compared U.S. mortality rates with those of Canada, Japan, and 16 Western European countries. "How many American lives would have been saved each year?" asked the researchers. "If U.S. mortality rates had matched those of other wealthy nations, a staggering number," is the answer. According to researchers, the U.S. started out of the gate in 1933 as a global health frontrunner, showing a significant advantage in mortality rates over the peer countries studied. But starting in 1970s, something went awry. Overall, Americans began to die at higher rates than their peers, a trend that grew steadily and picked up steam in the 2000s. By the year 2019, the number of annual excess deaths had reached a stunning 656,353. Bohr and his colleagues refer to these people who died as missing Americans, the friends, family members, and colleagues who would still be with them if only modern U.S. healthcare and social policy lived up to their early promise. Consider the figure of 656,353 missing Americans is the number of excess deaths just in the year 2019 alone. In a single year, Americans lost needlessly more than the population of Detroit, Las Vegas, or Baltimore, and this was before the pandemic. In 2021, the number of missing Americans swelled to 1,092,293. A whole lot more than you could put on milk cartons. More than Atlanta and Miami combined. Even worse, half of them were under age 65. Bohr and his fellow researchers found that, on average, not only were there more Americans dying relative to their peers abroad, the deaths were becoming younger. These are human beings who didn't have to live with their peer Americans. People who had children, elders, and neighbors to look after. Contributions to make, love and laughter to share. The researchers found a haunting way to help them envision the profound depth of the tragedy, based on the age at which Americans succumbed and the number of years they could have been expected to live had they been born in Finland, Spain, Japan, or other countries' studies. Bohr and colleagues tabulate that in a single year, 2021, America sustained 25 million years of life lost. Again, the figure of 25 million years of life lost is only for the year 2021. In 2022, as even more people die at 60 instead of 80, millions more future years of life will never be lived. The coronavirus is supposed to prey most viciously on the elderly. But in America, people still in their working years have been dropping away at higher rates during the pandemic than in peer nations, as they have been for years. Unsurprisingly, Black and Native Americans make up a disproportionate share of those vanished years and lives. Why, in a country with so much to spend and so much spent on medical care, are so many lives being cut short? How did Americans start out so well and end up so badly? Bohr notes that the American mortality advantage in the late 1930s and 1940s was impacted by the high death rates in peer countries due to the Second World War, and that the disadvantage of much of Europe and Japan likely continued for about a decade after the war because of the widespread devastation. But he also points to several other factors that probably helped Americans live longer into the 1950s, such as the relative strength of organized labor and consequent rising wages, plus the large public investments that helped boost the middle class, like the GI Bill and the promotion of high-income ownership, with the caveat that these advantages were primarily available to white Americans. Bohr observed that the later period of American mortality advantage was likely bolstered by Johnson's War on Poverty and the marked expansion of the safety net by Medicare and Medicaid, as well as the racial integration of hospitals in 1963 and environmental regulation which made water and air healthier, all of which these programs and policies took some of the gains that occurred in 1950s and expanded them so that it wasn't just people with middle-class incomes and white people who had access to the detriments of a healthy, long life, he explains. Yet even during the period of relative mortality advantages, America's inequality and structural racism likely held back the country's longevity record from being as good as it could have been. Older populations in the U.S. have tended to have better mortality outcomes relative to peer countries than younger groups. Bohr cites the fact that Americans have to reach the age of 65 before benefits like universal healthcare kick in as negatively impacting younger people's life expectancy. This age-related trend shifted somewhat from 1980 to 2000, but the researchers found that in the 2000s, the age-related mortality picture is clear. The story of the U.S. disadvantage is primarily about people under 65 dying at higher rates than in peer countries. The year when America's overall mortality numbers diverged from other wealthy nations is 1980, according to the researchers' findings. If the name Ronald Reagan comes to mind, you're not alone. Bohr notes that a Twitter discussion of the team's work has homed in on this association. However, he emphasizes that the story is more complicated than one man's presidency and its attendant policy changes, citing multiple factors such as the rise in opioid-related deaths in 2000s, as well as increasing deaths due to obesity, diabetes, and metabolic syndrome. Gun violence has also increased America's relative death toll.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha. Gabriel would inform Fatima al-Zahra about the Prophet's position with God the Merciful and his high status. He would tell her about the events that were to unfold for her children in the future. He would tell her about the things that would happen to Imam Hassan and the events of Karbala, the events that would happen to the other Imams, peace be upon them, and about the life of the Imam of the time, Ajjalallahu ta'ala faraju sharif. And the commander of the faithful would write these down. This is a very important matter. According to the Holy Quran, Gabriel descended upon someone other than the Prophet only once in history. Then we sent to her our spirit, and he appeared to her a well-made man. The Holy Quran, Surah 19, verse 17.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If the Arabic word ruh, soul, refers to Gabriel, there is some disagreement about this. In the story of Mary, the exalted God has only sent Gabriel to someone other than a prophet just once. Of course, other angels have frequently descended upon people, but Gabriel only one time. But in the case of Lady Zahra, the discussion isn't about him descending one or two times on her. Gabriel would visit her frequently and show his respect to Lady Zahra, peace be upon her. The Holy Quran speaks about Lady Fatima in the chapter The Man, Al-Insan, in the verse of purification, Tathir, and in the verse of Mubahila. These are verses that almost explicitly speak about Lady Zahra, peace be upon her. There are also verses that indirectly refer to that great personality as well. This is a very important point that the Exalted God speaks about Fatima al-Zahra's actions and those of her family in the chapter Al-Insan. This is a flag that the Holy Quran raises up and places on the door of the house of Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha. We only feed you for Allah's sake. We desire from you neither reward nor thanks. The Holy Quran, Surah 76, verse 9. These personalities work for God, are sincere, show purity and offer selfless services. To whom? To orphans, to the needy and to captives.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.